because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Hey, coach. Just before the podcast starts, I wanted to talk about my trip to New Zealand. I had such a great experience supporting coaches throughout the country in 10-plus days I was there, and one coach said, watching you coach concepts that have been explained on the podcast and through your website in a camp and clinic format really inspired me to raise my expectations of the players I coach while holding myself to a higher standard. The way you layered, phrased, and revisited points such as fight for your feet gave me practical sense of how to coach something and have it be constant expectations throughout the season. Such great feedback, and I'm so grateful that so many coaches in New Zealand got value out of my visit, and I look forward to continue to sharing the game. Coach, if you coach in the Las Vegas area, I'd love for you to reach out to me. I'm looking for a few things in Las Vegas and would love to connect with you. So reach out and enjoy the podcast.
Coach, it's a real treat. We have today Michael Lombardi is an NFL insider for The Athletic. And since the 1980s, Michael has been an executive in the front office of the 49ers, Browns, Eagles, and Raiders. And most recently in the NFL, he worked with the coaching staff of the Patriots, and he's author of The Gridiron Genius, a masterclass in winning championships and building dynasties in the NFL, and hosts his own podcast, The GM Shuffle. And coach, so many people have read Gridiron Genius that I know, and tremendous book, and tremendous honor to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
It's great to be here, Chris. I really appreciate it. Admire your work. I love to follow you. I learn stuff about basketball, and I think we share a lot of similar beliefs in how sometimes people think the wrong way. So I think this is great. Enjoy listening to you speak as well.
Well, and we got to give a shout out to The Daily Coach, which is another Twitter feed that you're involved in. And again, great information, wonderful. All coaches should follow that as well. And we'll get into that maybe at the end. But big thanks to the Boston Celtics and Brad Stevens for helping us connect through an event they held, eh?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that was incredibly powerful. I was honored to be invited there, and I learned a great deal from that seminar. It was a lot of fun.
For me, it was great because even though I'd read the book, just in person, so many things connect a little bit more in our little mini conversation as well, in addition to that. But the part that stood out for me is just how important divergent thinking is for coaches. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, I think we have a hard time understanding the difference between creative thinking and divergent thinking. John Irving, the novelist from Canada, by way of America, he is a creative thinker. He creates characters. Bill Walsh was a divergent thinker because he took an offense and he divergently thought of how he could make it utilize the skill set within the talent that he had. And so he didn't really reinvent the wheel. He just modified the wheel. And that's really what divergent thinking is modifying the wheel. It's not like we're going to come up with some new way of doing something. It's a way to where you're taking what you have and trying to figure out how all the pieces kind of fit together. And I think as coaches, you know, we're all paid to think divergently. We think we're paid to think creatively, you know, but that's for entrepreneurs to come up with an idea. I mean, even an entrepreneur, the definition of an entrepreneur is taking an existing idea and making it better, right? And I think that's ultimately requires divergent thinking. And so that's what coaches do as well.
Well, then the part that you put with that is this false duality. Can you talk about that? Because I think that brings home the picture of what you're trying to say quite a bit.
Well, you know, false duality is simply this. When people bring you a solution to a problem, we need to fix this and we should do A or B. The answer to what you need to do probably doesn't align with A or B. It probably needs to be examined from C, D, E, or F. You know, every time people give us a solution, there's always an A or B. That's false duality, two solutions to a problem. And they're never really two solutions. The great coaches find out where there's 5, 6, or 7, or 8 possible solutions to look into it. I mean, I wrote about this for The Daily Coach when Steve Jobs took over Apple. Everybody told him to get out of the hardware business. It was fairly easy for everybody to see the problem, right? Everybody understood we have a hardware problem. Our software is the greatest. If we eliminate hardware, here's the two steps we have to do, A or B. And Jobs being Jobs just said, you know what? That's not the solution I'm going to go for. I'm going to find something that's different than that. And he did, and he was successful. And I think that's the challenge. That requires hard work, requires thinking. requires being wrong at times, but it requires you to have enough self-confidence to not settle for the status quo.
And it's tremendously hard in my experience in sport, because sport follows a lot of cultural and historical norms in the way we coach and the way we approach problem solving. And have you found that in sport as well?
Yeah, I think we have this blackbird mentality, and that blackbird mentality is simply this: one blackbird leaves the vine, they all leave, right? You know, and so we have a copycat mentality. We see it with our play selection. We see it with how people try to do different things. And I think it's really problematic. I think, you know, if Walsh used to say all the time, and this is probably why I'm wired this way, is if we're all thinking alike, no one's thinking. And if you take that as the foundation for what you believe in, and then I worked with probably the most contrarian thinker of all, Bill Belichick, who's never going to take the status quo of anything. If I remember telling Bill, you know, we get a ton of people at training camp to watch practice, you know, and it was like, and then the first day of, this is like when he first got the job in February, and then the first day in August when there were people out there, he's like, you call this a lot of people? And there was like 4,000 people. Like, you know, he just knew to never believe what people just automatically say is the right thing. And he doesn't go along with it. And I think that that's a trait you have to have. People call it negative thinking. I don't. I think it's really, it's powerful and it's empowering.
And how does that all fit into this philosophy of stoicism, which I know, again, is something that you've helped popularize a little bit in terms of explaining what a lot of successful coaches are like?
I think that the idea of stoicism is you've got to have a belief system within who you are, and you can't get emotional within it. You know, call chess players, grandmaster chess players, stoics, right? Because they sit there and look at the board and they don't get emotionally over a move and react to it, or they don't feel like, you know, they don't lose control of their emotions. They stay within the moment. And I think in sports, in anything we do, staying in the moment and going to the next play is one of the big things we teach. You can't change yesterday. You can't change the bad play. Yes, you know, you can't change the bad play. Move to the next play. Move to the next play. That's all what stoicism is teaching us, is live in the present, live in the moment. You know, don't let your past mistakes carry you down and let them hurt you twice. And I think that's what you can get from it. And sometimes it's hard to identify with these Roman emperors and warriors and Marcus Aurelius and all them. But I think the reality of it is the principles that they take, the belief system, letting it go is really, really beneficial for all coaches.
It's absolutely beneficial. And from experience, easier said than done. But this observational state, this analytical state rather than emotional state, it is just so important, especially in game moments. And but it contradicts what kind of popular media portrays a coach as. And it comes back to, again, this divergent thinking, these false dualities, that the great coaches or the coaches that are secure don't care about that, right? They don't care about how they're represented. They just do their job.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that's where I wrote about this too for the Daily Coach, is when you have personal freedom, right? As a coach, you really, one of the things in your tool belt you have to have is personal freedom. If you don't have personal freedom, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. And the personal freedom that Belichick gets, he gets it from the 6 trophies. People think he gets wealth from the 6 trophies. He gets fame from the 6 trophies. No, he gets personal freedom from the 6 trophies because he knows what he's doing is the right thing. And he didn't really need 6 trophies to get his own personal freedom. He probably had it before he even got 1. But he believes in a core. He believes in a principle of what he wants to do to be successful. And he doesn't let the morning paper or the morning Twitter feed or Snapchat or Instagram affect that, because he doesn't read any of it. Because that truly is outside his world and he wants nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I was going to say he probably doesn't read it for sure. But the personal freedom, so divergent thinking, false duality, personal freedom, stoicism. What's the advice to a developing coach? What's the advice to a young coach in your experience in observing so many coaches?
You know, I think you have to try to spend as much time understanding how to build culture. I've just been reading this book by Ben Horowitz, which is a fascinating book, and it's called What You Do Is Who You Are. And it talks about Shaka Sengur, which was real name's James White. He was a young man who was, like most kids that grow up in urban America, on that really thin line between I'm going to do good or I'm going to be a bad guy, right? And in urban America, Detroit, where Shaka grew up, that line is very narrow. When he came home one day at 9 years old, he showed his mother his report card, and he got all A's on it, and she basically threw a pot at his head because that's not what she wanted for him. She wanted him to go into a different world where there could have been a lot of money, drugs, whatever. And at that moment, he started living in the streets. He started living. And at 19, he ends up in prison for murder. And it was his time in prison that I think that young coaches should really resonate to, not being in prison, but what he did with his mind when he was in prison. He started studying great leaders. He started studying great cultures and how they build those cultures and what it takes to build those cultures and how you as a leader must act within those cultures. And I think that's what we really need to spend more time studying. We spend so much time studying X's and O's. I like this play. I like that play. I like this offense. I like that offense. We don't ever spend enough time on culture. And the secret sauce in New England, the secret sauce for Bill Walsh, the secret sauce for the U.S. hockey team, the secret sauce for the Golden State Warriors is ultimately their culture. It isn't anything other than culture.
And we'll come back to culture because I know it's such a big piece and, you know, a lot of ways to talk about it, but I love how you frame it. But speaking to these things, I've always talked about it's not what you teach, it's how you teach, and spending more time on this concept of how you're actually teaching. And that's obviously relates to relationships and all those things you say. So what are some things that you've observed from these successful people, successful coaches, about how they interact with their athletes, with their employees, with their people in their organization?
I think the number one thing is they're honest. And when you are honest with personal freedom, you don't mind confrontation. You do not have any trouble telling people the hard conversations. If a player, and you're a young coach, and you, as a player, you're coaching, and you want them to like you, you better get out of coaching. You want them to respect you. But respect only comes from knowledge. Respect only is gained through your willingness to make him better. And to make him better, you have to tell him the truth. Players don't like bullshitters. Players don't like guys that are just going to tell them what they want to hear, because at the end of the day, that's really not what they need to be able to compete at the highest level. They want to be pushed. They want to be motivated. They want you to do the things you have to do to help them become better. And if you're a 60-year-old white guy or an 18-year-old African-American and you can help a player become better, it don't matter. It sees no color. It only sees information. So as a young coach, you've got to be able to handle that. You've got to be able to be really intellectually challenging. You've got to be willing to speak your mind. If somebody doesn't do the things that you're asking them to do, you've got to be willing to confront them and tell them what they need to do. And remind them that, look, I'm doing this because I'm coaching you. I'm not criticizing you. Coaching and criticism are two entirely different things. Two entirely different things. When the media says something about you, they have no interest in you doing better. They're criticizing you. When I say something about you, I want you to do better. I'm coaching you.
Such a great point. And something I highlighted from our talk, or from your talk when I saw you talk, was confrontation cannot scare you, must deal with it, must love it. And I think the example you were giving was about Belichick, that he doesn't outsource confrontation. And I thought that was such a powerful message for a head coach.
Yeah, and he's not passive aggressive with it. You know, he's not trying to be liked. He told me a long time ago, he said, if you're going to do contracts for the Browns, you know, the players may not like you. You got to be willing to handle that. And you do. If you're going to be outspoken about things in sports, people are not going to like it. You got to be able to handle it. But you got to sleep at night knowing you're saying what you truly believe. Look, the challenge that we have for all young coaches in this world we live in today, because of the social media, because the world's flat, because there can be such uprisings based on Twitter or Snapchat or Instagram or whatever, is most of these coaching jobs you're going to get into are really elected jobs. They're not selected. They're elected. And because they're elected, if the election affects how you coach, if the election affects how you handle confrontation, then you're not going to be a very good coach. You have to be willing to criticize players or coach players that might have an influence in the media. right? Like, let's just take Michael Bennett, for example, the defensive lineman for the New England Patriots. The Patriots trade with the Philadelphia Eagles. They acquire him. Okay, they redo his contract. He goes up to New England. He's always been a difficult guy to handle, right? Belichick coaches him. Then he doesn't feel he has a place on the team. They kind of slowly don't play him. He's upset. They suspend him for a game. Belichick then trades him down to Dallas, right?
Yep.
Most of people would say, well, now Bennett's going to rip Belichick because he was wrong with him. No. Bennett went out of his way to talk about how wonderful Belichick is. He went out of his way to talk about how much he learned football from him. They didn't necessarily agree on playtime, but it didn't stop the respect from one to the other. And I think that's where coaches miss the point. You try to get elected, you become a man of no principles. You become a man who's willing to say anything to get the job. And if you want to be a politician, like a lot of them in America are, you won't get anything done, like a lot don't get done. And if you want to go the political route, you'll probably lose at some point because somebody will out-politicize you. But if you want to be really good and eventually get selected, you got to be willing to do those things.
Well, I love this because it frames the conversation away from hard coaching to honest coaching. And there is a big difference, right? You don't need to be a competitive asshole to be able to coach people. You need to be honest and upfront. I imagine that's the Michael Bennett situation. From day one, he was communicated with.
Right.
He knew his situation.
You have to. Players want that. If you're going to hide behind, you don't want to talk to the guy and you can't have a difficult conversation, then you're probably not meant to be in coaching. You're just not meant to do it, you know, and you can't be an asshole about it, but you've got to be willing. Belichick rarely raises his voice. Bill Walsh rarely raises his voice. They're not emotional. They're very, hey, look, here's where we're wrong. Here's the way I see it. Now, I could be completely wrong. I could be completely screwed up. I admit there's a margin of error here, but here's what I feel. And here's the decisions I've made based on how I feel.
So
you got to be willing to do it.
Yeah, you say that. Did you notice these coaches and these different executives been around? Do they acknowledge their fallibility? Do they acknowledge the fact that they can be wrong? They say that openly?
You sure? I mean, look, there's never a time where the Patriots don't play well where Belichick doesn't say we got to coach better. Never, never. And when you stand in front of your team and say, for us to improve next year, we have to do these things, you better include the coach in the improvement. I need to do a better job in this. I need to do a better job in that. We need to, you know, it's just not always on the players have to play better or play harder. You know, I wrote a blog for the Daily Coach. Do you think Michael Jordan ever had anybody tell him to play harder?
Guessing not.
No, of course not. No coach ever had to tell him to play harder. Playing hard is like a carpenter showing up without his tool belt, you know, like his hammer. That's a part of the job is to play hard.
Well, it's so funny because I have this conversation with a colleague quite a bit about scouting reports and how we write in the most obvious things sometimes. That, like, you got to play hard. You got to rebound. You got to get back in defense. Like, as you said, those should be part of your toolkit. And you shouldn't have to write them in.
No, I mean, that's not coaching. You're not making me better by telling me I got to play hard. Yeah. You got to show me how I'm not playing hard and then show me players that play to a higher degree. That's called coaching. But just telling me to play hard ain't going to get it done. Just telling me to do something doesn't mean I'm going to be able to do it. You've got to explain it and show it to them. Look, this is the standard. You got to have principles. Here's the standard of what we're going to accept. This is unacceptable.
I imagine that these type of coaches you've been around, that they handle a win and a loss the same way. Is there a consistency to everything they do?
Yeah, I think there really is. And I actually think that the losing is more powerful than the winning. I think when, you know, after every game, you have to do an autopsy, a complete, thorough autopsy. And I don't really give a crap. We play 82 games. We don't have any time. We got to get on to the next game. No. How can you get on to the next game if you didn't understand why you won or lost the last game? And how are you going to improve your football team, basketball team, hockey team, badminton team if you don't understand the mistakes that caused you to lose or you don't understand what could have caused you to lose even though you won? We're in such a rush to go to the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. We spend no time on the current and how do we improve. It's like, Chris, you become a head coach of some major college in America and the first thing they want to know is what's your plan for the next 100 days? Right. They want to know what your plan is for the next 100 days.
Well, yeah, I've seen that question.
Right. It's a horrible question because you the answer should be, no, I'm not looking at the first 100 days. I need to spend I need to figure out what happened here for the last 2 years, because if I don't fix those problems, I'm going to get fired just like the last guy did. We all think we're coming in because we're greater than the last coach. We all come in because we think we're the savior. We're Vince Lombardi. We're the greatest coach in the world, right? We can fix all these problems. If we don't understand what the problems were before that we're dealing with, how can we ever fix them?
Well, I imagine this, and I'm curious your answer, because I even go to the point of saying that, like, learning is non-linear. It's not this linear thing, but we create these perfect plans and these season plans and stuff, and then we sometimes hold ourselves to them as coaches, but it really is a game-to-game assessment. And I imagine that's how Belichick works, right? It's each game's a unique thing, and you're going to learn from the last, but then the planning for that next one is going to be not dictated by this overall plan. It's what is going to help us win that next game. Is that right?
Okay. And that's stoicism. That's we're in the moment here. What happened before, you know, it's like whatever we did before doesn't really matter. You know, and I have this coming out on Monday on the Daily Coach. It's called the ego mirror. Like, we all let our egos, when we have success, get in the way of us having continued success. And the ego mirror is really just a story about this. It's a fictitious story about a Latin American rebel who takes over an office and walks into the office of this former dictator. And as the former dictator's walking out, he says, "You look in this mirror, and this mirror will tell you who all your enemies are." And so naturally, the new dictator starts looking in this magical mirror, and he sees faces of all the people that helped him get into power, helped him lead the rebel rising, and he starts having them assassinated. Well, you know, months later, he's left alone, and eventually a new rebel comes in and sweeps him out of office, and he looks in the mirror, and all he sees is his face. And what the mirror was telling him was, this is, when we have success, it's not because of one person. It's not us. We have to incorporate our team. We're building on something that's bigger than all of us. And if we let our egos get in the way of decisions, if we let our ego get in the way of not listening, if we let our egos get in the way of always wanting to be in charge of talking, we're going to be like that dictator who's going to be overthrown.
Now, what a powerful story that is. And leads into something that I know you talk about throughout the book as being really important for so many of these coaches, and that's character assessment. But the reality is, that's not easy to do. So is there any advice that you can provide for coaches in terms of character assessment?
You know who gives the greatest advice on character assessment is Oprah. You know, Oprah and Howard Stern, I think you would recognize as two of the greatest interviewers of all time.
No question.
And you wonder how they do it, right? And to be a really good interviewer, you have to make the person feel vulnerable. And you have to have a conversation with them. And you can't ask questions that are just, you can't look down at your paper and ask the next question. Because when you do that, you're not listening to the answer, right? So you have to be able to assess character. You've got to really make the person feel vulnerable and ask questions that you're going to get some sense of an honest answer, and then you can figure it out. For example, if I said to you, "Did you work hard today?" you would say, "Oh yeah, I worked hard. I just got back from working out." But if I said to you, "You know, today is Wednesday, today is Friday. On Friday, what's your normal exercise routine? Tell me what you did. Tell me what time you went. Tell me how many reps you did with it," and make me have to define every single thing I did, and I'd start stammering around. You know, not a lot of guys are like like Will Hunting, who can name his brother and sisters back and forth like he did in that movie. You know, when she asked him to do it again and he did it because she didn't really believe him. Not a lot of people can tell you what they did when they didn't do it. They can't believe themselves. So that's the number one thing on character assessment. You've got to be a really good interviewer. You've got to be willing to, and then you've got to put the player, and remember, past performance predicts future achievement. So go back into his character and ask questions about what happened in his life. And then the other thing you have to do is put him in a situation where, if this happens, what would you do? How would you handle that?
And that's so important, that part of it, because, I mean, we've seen it with Belichick that he can look at past performance, he can look at those things, but there must be some personal belief that he does it different and he can change someone. Is that part of it too? Or is that sometimes that we just bang our head against the wall and just think we can change someone, but we really can't?
Well, we learned this a long way, right? So we know we can't change competitiveness. Right. We've resigned that. Competitiveness is the one thing we can't instill. Mom and dad gave you that, and you either have it or you don't, right? And so, but what we can change is your work habits. You know, we can change your work habits, and where you have to be really careful as an evaluator is to understand that somebody that works hard, that's not competitive, you're wasting your time. But somebody that is competitive but doesn't work hard, you have a chance to change. You have a chance to change. We'll get them in shape. We'll get them to work harder. We can't just get them to compete. So you've got to understand what you're dealing with. And when you get somebody who's lazy, doesn't work hard, but will compete on Saturdays or Sundays or whenever you play, you've got to hope they have pride. You've got to resort to their pride to get them to change. And if you can do that, you got a player.
So is so much of it appealing to something bigger than themselves? Is that part of the organizational success of many of these organizations?
Yeah, if the name on the front doesn't mean more than the name on the back, it's probably not going to work. It's not going to work. I mean, it just doesn't work. I mean, that's why all-star teams don't work. You know, it's why nobody really likes to watch the NBA all-star game. You know, we want teams that are unified, that play together, that overcome. You know why? It's funny. Again, I wrote this on the Daily Coach as well. We love the Washington Nationals story. We love a team that was 19-31 to May and then turns it around and wins the World Series. We love that. We love the guy who's behind in the race and finishes strong. We love those stories. You know the stories we hate? We hate dynasties. You know why? Because we can't figure out why teams have dynasties. We can't figure it out because we can't identify with competitive stamina. We don't understand competitive stamina. We don't understand how to do it, how to handle it. So we fall in love with the one-time place, when in reality, we have to fall in love with the teams that understand how to coach and teach competitive stamina. And if you find players that like that because they value the name on the front, you'll continue to win.
So what are some of the things that you've seen to assess competitiveness? Is it just evaluation of practice, film, interview? What are some of the things that come forward for you?
I think when you know somebody's competitive is when you ask them about, you know, what their achievements are as it relates to them and they talk about their team, right? We won this, we won that. You know, when they become individualistic, I was player of the week this week, then you realize that they're only competing for themselves. So I think you find it in the way they carry themselves, the way they behave.
That's a great example for sure. And thinking about, often I get asked, especially by young head coaches or new head coaches at whatever level they're coaching at, they ask me quite a bit about staff organization, how to involve assistants, how to organize assistants. What are some things that have come through for you in terms of understanding how to organize your staff?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is understand putting together a staff is like putting together a band. You need a bass player. You need a drummer. You need different people to do different things that have different skill set. If they're all like you, you probably aren't going to play very good music. You need different elements. The other thing you need is you don't necessarily need experience. You need experience and wisdom from outside the building, not inside the building. What often happens to young coaches is they get told by the athletic director, they get told by the, you should hire somebody who's got great experience. You know, that'll really help you. Well, that's great. The problem is with that is when you hire somebody with great experience, they're experienced in doing things the way they want to do it. And when they don't do it their way, they raise an eyebrow. They shrug a shoulder. They flip themselves. And that shrug of a shoulder, that raise of an eyebrow really ruins culture. Where if you outsource experience, if you had somebody who mentoring you from the outside and say, hey, here's my situation, how would you handle it? That's the experience you need outside the building, not in. And then you have to have defined roles by every single guy written up. When you go to an interview, you say, here's the staff I want. You don't have to have names of it. Here's the criteria that the guy has to have, girl has to have. Here's the qualifications I'm looking for. Here's where the areas of strength are. Here's the type of person I'm looking for. Because remember, building a staff is no different. It's no different than acquiring player personnel. It's no different than a draft. The FBI doesn't search for serial killers in the phone book. They build a profile for what they want based on the knowledge and the information they have. You as an up-and-coming head coach, you've got to have a profile for every single position you're going to hire, down to the ball boy. So when you walk into the AD's office, or you walk into the head, the president, the team president's office, or the owner's team, you say, here's who I want, and describe it. I want somebody who's going to be my chief of staff, who's Jesuit educated, whatever it is, whatever you feel is important. You know, I want somebody strong in language. I want somebody who can do these, whatever you feel like you need. And then you bring that together and you find it. You're building a band. You're not just hiring your friends.
Well, it reminds me of obviously Bill Campbell, tremendous mentor to so many executives and tech billionaires, I would say, and someone like that. And then thinking about that in the story of that, like Belichick has always surrounded himself with mentor type people, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, that Bill has a circle of people that he'll call that when he needs something or he wants to bounce an idea off somebody, he does. And they don't necessarily have to be in the building. And frankly, I think sometimes he likes it when they're not, because he doesn't really, even though everybody thinks that he wants them to tell him what he wants to hear, he does it.
Yeah. And that's so hard for especially a new head coach to know that. But those mentors outside of your inner circle help you so much in that way. And I know I've always used one, and it's been tremendous for me. So, Coach, one of my favorite quotes, I think it was from the book, is the best way to win is first not to lose. And yeah. I think you call it inverse theory, right?
Yep. So
it's can you talk about that?
You know, we all get so caught up in how we have to win our sport, right? And I think that the great coaches always reverse engineer it. How do we avoid losing before we win? In football, if we turn this ball over, we're going to lose. If we miss field goals, we're going to lose. If we don't convert red zone third downs, we're going to lose. If we give up big plays, we're going to lose. And there's a list of five. So we practice those. If we miss tackles, we're going to lose. So we practice tackling. If we don't secure the football, we're going to lose. Practice securing the football every day. If we don't, you know, red zone third downs, we practice them. So the first thing you have to have is a core principles of what you must be really good at that'll allow you not to lose the game, right? The quickest way to lose a game is make mental mistakes, turn the ball over. But all right, we're practicing that. Now you would say, well, that's negativity. No, that's just being smart. That's how you handle it. And then once you get those skills underneath your belt, now let's work on the areas that we kept to win the game, because we can't win this game if we do these things. So we better practice them every single day. I mean, John Wooden did the same drills every single day of his basketball practices. Why? Because that was the core to how he was going to avoid losing. Most people get caught up and he did the same drills, but they never asked why he did the drills. He did the drills to avoid losing.
The thing that I've started asking the people that I mentor in our BI Platinum group and some of the private stuff I do is, what are you intentionally not good at? And it's a question for coaches to say, hey, listen, we have to know if we're going to lose, this is how we're going to lose, because this is what we're giving up. But we're going to be really good at these other areas. Does that fit in this inverse theory?
No doubt. So let's just take, for example, we're recording this on the 22nd of November. The Patriots are playing the Cowboys, right? And I don't know this to be true, but my sense of knowing how Belichick operates would be, we're going to double Amari Cooper in this game. We're going to stop Zeke Elliott from running around the edge. And we're going to make those two players not beat us, allow them to beat us. I'll put Stephon Gilmore on Michael Gallup, my best corner on their second best receiver. I'm going to double their best receiver in Amari Cooper. And I'm going to set a hard edge in the defense. Great. So now what happens? Randall Cobb or Jason Witten's got to win the game for him. And if I lose the game because Cobb had a huge day and Witten had a huge day, then life goes on. I got to move on with it. But if I'm not losing this game is if these other players beat us. That's how you have to break down every single game. Every game. No matter who you're playing.
I love it. Love it. The myth of coaches working long hours and sleeping in the office. Is this what you've seen, or is this just a myth that exists?
Well, the thing that I have trouble with it is the fact that, look, being someplace doesn't necessarily mean you're getting anything done. right? Just because you're in the office, are you productive? I tell coaches all the time, think of your life as a lawyer. Think of your life as you have to be paid by the time you book. Lawyers only make money if they book their hours against this case, that case, and this. When you come to work in the morning, if you spend 45 minutes on social media, you get a good workout in for an hour, you know, you shoot the shit at the coffee stand for another 45 minutes. Are you really there all day? Are you really getting something done? Again, this goes back to really having personal freedom. When you have personal freedom, you don't really worry about what's on page six. You're not worried about what's on Twitter. You're not worried about really what's going on outside the world. You may read 5 minutes and then you get on with your world. And I think that that's really why coaches spend too much time in the office, because if they broke down their day on how productive they were, I think they would realize they have a little bit more time than they do. Remember, one thing Bill Gates says all the time, the one thing I have all the money in the world, and the one thing I can't buy is more time. You have time. You're wasting it when you're doing stupid shit.
Definitely. I'm always intrigued with the coach's mindset and preparation going into practice. Have you noticed something particular about coaches going into practice that are, you know, are tremendous teachers and have tremendous success within their organization?
I think that you have to make practice execution become game reality. You got to make practice really hard. Belichick takes practice on a couple of different levels. First of all, when it's shitty weather out, like today on the East Coast, it's horrendous weather. He's going outside. He don't give a crap. Because why? Well, he's not going to have a good practice the Friday before game. He's coaching mental toughness. You got to be mentally tough to endure. So that's part of what we're trying to get done in practice. We want mental toughness. We're going outside, right? We want it to be hard. We don't want the offense to know what the script is so that they put the shittiest defense against the script. We're not going out there to have perfect plays. We're going out there to have game-like conditions so that we can coach against what's going to happen in the game. Right? Here's what they're going to do. If I run a strong safety blitz into a reverse, who am I helping? I know the reverse is coming, so I run a strong safety blitz into the reverse. Does that really help us win? Of course it doesn't help us win, right? Do the things at practice that are going to help you win, not make you look good. Again, this goes back to ego. It goes back to the most important fundamentals is, does it matter how we win or does it matter that we just win?
Yeah, such good stuff. And again, comes back to this whole philosophy that you've talked about throughout. And I imagine it's the same if we're talking about how these coaches handle frustration when players struggle with skills or concepts. And it's a teaching environment, right? Like it's a learning environment. It's not just, hey, we tell you and you have to do this right away. I imagine there's some patience in the process too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where most coaches don't put their GM hats on. Right. So the GM is always more patient for the player than the coach is, because the GM doesn't have to coach him every day. Right. So the GM's up in his office and he doesn't have to deal with the guy, you know, not remembering everything that he's been told every single day. That's a plight. But I think you have to make an agreement mutually within an organization. Look, we're not going to make you coach anybody. Right. That once we determine the guy can't play. We value your time. We value your effort. We value your coaching, that we're not going to waste it on coaching backups. We're going to coach guys that we think have potential to start. And once you make that agreement, I think you get the coaches, they realize that they're not wasting their time. And sometimes coaches, after one practice, I'll get this guy out of here. He's not good enough, you know? I mean, the great Larry Brown story of George McGinnis, right? I mean, Larry Brown is on Al Atlas's general manager. For years, when they were going from the ABA to the NBA, we got to get George McGinnis. We got to get George McGinnis. We got to get George McGinnis. 2 years later, they trade Bobby Jones and I think a first round pick, and they get George McGinnis. The first day of practice, George McGinnis is at practice. Larry walks up to the GM's office and says, "We got to trade this guy. He's no good." You know, that's the lack of patience and understanding that sometimes coaches innately have. And a guy like Larry, who's really good at coaching, probably has said that about a lot of players, but he just keeps coaching them.
He definitely keeps coaching them. Tremendous. Let's get to the culture piece then, because I love the way, obviously, you talk about a culture trump strategy. I don't know if we'll get into all the different things, but quickly, let's touch on culture as a strategy.
Well, I mean, I think, look, I think you've got to have a way to where you're defining what is the culture. You know, culture is not like something we're just going to spray for, pest control, and we're going to have it inside the building here. We've sprayed for culture. What truly is your culture? Who do you want to be? Right? It's not a mission statement. Like, that's where people, I think, get confused. Culture is a living and breathing document that has to be maintained on an every single day basis. And your actions of how you as the leader behave within the culture determine the culture, right? If you tell people like Jeff Bezos did, we want to be economically sound. We're not going to be fruit. We're not going to be a waste of money. And everybody's going to have a desk that's basically an old door that we've put four legs on, and we made it a desk. Then, I can't be sleeping at the Four Seasons every single night. Like, that's not culture. Like, that's not culture. Your actions do the culture. So what are the four things or the three things that your culture believes in? Loyalty, is it trust? In New England, the four pillars of their culture are real simple. Do your job, be attentive, speak for yourself, and put the team first. That's their culture. That's their culture. It's not win a Super Bowl. It's not make the playoffs. It's not, we're going to be the most dominant sports team in history. No, we're going to do those four things every day. What's our creed? What is our code of conduct? That's our culture. And then everybody has to adhere to the culture. No one's bigger than the culture. No one's allowed to be absolved from the culture. And once people know it, they'll behave within it.
Well, and imagine with that in an organization like the Patriots, it's not just a speech at the beginning of the year. It's not just something hanging on the wall. This is something they talk about every day.
Yeah. I mean, I think the number one way you can develop your culture is when you train new people. It's like, what do they tell you all the time? How do you learn something? Teach it, right?
Absolutely.
Well, how do you know your culture if you don't teach it? The Navy SEALs teach their culture every 8 weeks of budget training, right? They do it over and over and over again. They know what their culture is. They have no problem teaching it. They tell you what it's going to take to be a Navy SEAL. Well, if you run a company or you run a basketball team, a football team, you better tell every new recruit what it's going to take to be part of your culture. And you can't lie to them. You can't lie to them. I mean, I thought John Calipari, I heard him speak. I did a seminar with him at the Final Four. And when he told the parents, he said, look, I tell every parent, this is the last conversation we're ever going to have about your son's playing time. We'll talk about his school anytime you want. We'll talk about his behavior anytime you want. But don't call me and ask me about what he's going to play, because I can't promise you he's going to play. He's got to earn it. That's culture. That's culture.
Yeah, people know up front and they know it on a daily basis what it takes to be able to play or in that example. So it's great. You also talk about an operating framework. Is this a general thing for organizations, or is this specific to one organization that you've talked about?
The behavior within the organization?
Yeah.
The way you operate? Yeah. I mean, look, everything you do is dedicated to the culture. And when you go outside the lines of the culture and someone doesn't tell you, for example, if you're Baker Mayfield and people, well, he's made $2 million from Progressive. He should have commercials. Great. We don't have a culture, but he has commercials, right? That's a wonderful thing, right? How we operate the culture, how we discipline ourselves within the culture. If I were the GM in Cleveland and I had complete authority, I would have said to Baker Mayfield, Baker, look, here's the reality. You do this, you hurt the team. You hurt the team. I would tell his agent, your agent has no interest in helping the team. He has every interest in helping you. I get it. But you're going to mess up the team, because by you doing this, it's only going to put more burden on the team as you stand out. We're a team. We're not one player.
No, it was such a great example and a great point. But, again, that comes back to the purpose, not just for the organization, but for the person as well, in terms of their goals and what they expect out of what they're doing and why they're playing sport to a certain extent as well. And imagine that comes back to the character assessment as well.
No doubt. I mean, I think you definitely have to, find people that can absorb it. Look, as good as the Navy is, I mean, and we know this more than anything, the United States Navy has spent zillions of dollars trying to figure out why they invite 160 people to budge training and only 25 make it. Like, why is their margin so great? Well, the one thing we can't figure out in most life is volume. We can't figure out how much people can tolerate and how much they can't. And Bud's training is really all about volume. As simple as it is, it's just volume. Everybody can do push-ups, everybody can do sit-ups, everybody can do chin-ups, everybody can run the mile, and everybody can do it. But the problem is, on day 55, can you do it with as much enthusiasm as you did it on day two? That's volume. That's where they lose it. That's where great coaches lose out. You know, you're getting ready to play Buffalo, who's maybe no good, and you've beaten Buffalo 35 times. You cut the corner on Buffalo, you know, and you lose. Whereas the guys with competitive stamina treat Buffalo like it's the first time they ever played them. The guys who make Navy SEALs realize that day 55 is no different than day two.
Well, there's probably no better piece of advice from all of this than, again, coming back to that point about how every game, every practice is a unique experience. And to disconnect from the emotion of whatever's happened and to focus on that moment and that process. And that's tremendous and tremendously difficult, right? This is not easy. And I imagine none of these great coaches you've ever been around started in this place. It's something that you have to work on.
You work on it every day. Mental toughness is a muscle you have to work on every day. Physical toughness, reading is a muscle you got to work on every day. What did I learn today? How did I get better? What am I doing to make myself better? You know, it's what I call the David Crosby theory. You know, a lot of coaches subscribe to the David Crosby theory, and he said it so well. David Crosby, the former lead singer of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, he said this. He said, when a new artist, take the word artist out, put coach in, comes up with his first batch of songs, those 15 songs that he puts on the album, those 15 new concepts of plays or strategy, that's 30 years worth of his life. That's been building for some time. It's his next album, whether he knows whether he's talent or not. It's what you do after you think you know it all is when you find out how smart you are, John Wooden. And I think that's the essence of all of this, is how are we changing? What's our next album going to be like? What's the next 13 songs going to be like?
Michael, I cannot thank you enough. I know so many of us have been influenced by all of your sharing, and the Daily Coach at the Daily _ Coach is tremendous and a wonderful resource that so many coaches need to get on. But we can read you at The Athletic and the GM Shuffle. And then obviously the book, if you haven't read it, is tremendous. So everyone go get the Gridiron Genius book and read it. But any last words to leave us with, Michael?
No, thank you, Chris. I think the last words are, no matter what sport we're in, at the end of the day, we're in the same sport.
So true. So true. Thanks again.
Thank you, Chris.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.